let's begin by going to Numbers 26, Numbers 26, where Gog is mentioned, and Gog is actually first mentioned in the book of Chronicles, or I should say in the book of Genesis, as being a descendant of Reuben. And Reuben was the firstborn of Jacob, as we well know. Reuben had lost the birthright because of sexual misconduct, but Reuben was not cut off from the family. Reuben and his lineage went on to become a significant tribe among the people of Israel. And there are three brief genealogies of Reuben found in the Bible. The first is Genesis 46 and verse 9 that briefly states that the sons of Reuben were Hanok, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi. And there's another genealogy found in the book of Numbers that gives us a bit more detail. Numbers 26 and verse 5 says that Reuben was the firstborn of Israel. The children of Reuben were Hanok, the family of the Hanokites, and Palu, the family of the Paluites, of Hezron, the family of the Hezronites, of Carmi, the family of the Carmites. So Reuben had four sons, and these became ancestors of thousands of individuals. As it continues to say in verse 7, these are the families of the Reubenites. And those who were numbered of them at that time of this recording were 43,730 individuals. So this is the number of the Reubenites at the time of the Exodus. And in this brief list, Gog is not mentioned as being a son of Reuben, as in the first generation, becoming a significant clan, if you will, of the tribe of Reuben. Gog is mentioned at a later time in history when the books of Chronicles of Israel were written. And so let's go over there to First Chronicles and chapter 5. And we will read verses 3 through 6, where it says that the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, were Hanok, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi. And then it says the sons of Joel were Shemaiah, his son, Gog, his son, Shimei, his son, Micah, his son, Rehai, his son, and Baal, his son. So this genealogy follows the line of Reuben through an individual by the name of Joel. So because Joel is not mentioned as being a first generation son of Reuben, he must be a son of one of Reuben's sons, making him a grandson of Reuben. And the opinion that Joel was either a son of Carmi, who was last mentioned here in verse 3, or that he was a son of Reuben's firstborn, Hanok, because the firstborn lineage is often considered the most noteworthy, and so that's why it was documented. And so the conclusion is this Joel was a grandson of Reuben, and that would make Gog a great, great grandson of Reuben. And so let's go over to Genesis in chapter 10, Genesis 10, to consider the first mention of Magog. Magog is rendered as existing much further back in time. And in Genesis 10, in verse 1, it says, this is the genealogy of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And sons were born to them after the flood. And the sons of Japheth were Gomer, Magog, Madawi, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. So Magog was one of Japheth's seven sons, and therefore a grandson of Noah. And some believe, and I believe as well, that Japheth is the father of the Asian people, that his name is actually related to the term Japan, the nation of Japan. It's also thought that Japheth's sons gave rise to the Persians, who today are predominantly found among the Russian people. And we'll talk a bit more about that later. So there is no further documentation in the Bible regarding the line of Magog through particular persons, that is, and the same is the case for Gog. However, there are indications of where the clans of these people settled and how populous they had become. In fact, there is evidence both in the Bible as well as extra-biblical historical texts that speak of these people as becoming nations and even empires. And so we can first consider a few extra-biblical documents. In the book of Jubilees, it's said that all the inner portions of the north were given to Magog, and that Gog inhabited an area next to Japheth's borders. And that's found on pages 73 through 76 in the book of Jubilees, an English translation, obviously. The book of Biblical Antiquities, also called the Biblical Antiquities of Philo, believed to be written by somebody that was writing under the pseudonym Philo. These were written in the mid-first and or second centuries. And this document names seven sons of Magog's descendants. It names them as Sesi, Thipha, Faruta, Amiel, Phimiag, Goloza, and Samanic. Then this writing goes on to say that 340 years after the flood of Noah's time, that is, that the sons of Magog were considered princes that were princes over some 6,200 people. In the documents, Antiquities of the Jews, written by Josephus, he wrote that Japheth, the son of Noah, had seven sons, and they inhabited so that the beginning of the mountains of Taurus and Amanus, and these are mountain ranges found in modern-day Turkey, and they proceeded along Asia as far as the river Tanais, or Tanais, which is people know that river as T-A-N-A-I-S today, and along Europe to Cadiz, and settling themselves on the lands which they light upon, which none had inhabited before, they called the nations by their own names. For Gomer founded those whom the Greeks now call Galatians, or Gauls, but were then called Gomerites. And so we see Josephus relating the people in Galatia, the native people of Galatia, to this son of Japheth, Gomer. Magog, he says, founded those that from him were named Magogites, but who are by the Greeks called Scythians. Very familiar term and a familiar people in ancient history. So according to Josephus, these people are directly related to major settlements in Galatia, in Asia, and in Scythia. And these are all areas found north and east of Israel. There are a number of historical stories about these people of Gog and Magog that have yet to be proven, and therefore they would fall into the category of legend. There might be some facts among them that are accurate and some that are not. As noted by Josephus and others, he had written that these Magogites had inspired Alexander the Great to erect barriers between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea in order to keep these hostile, uncivilized, as they were called, barbarian-type people of the north from invading the south. And according to some of these legends, Gog and Magog were said to be human flesh eaters, and they had even been characterized in ancient art as being beastly, with very much bodily hair and notably crooked beak-like noses. But the portrayals of Gog and Magog in this way do not mean that these people were mythical or people that were of legend. It simply means that they had long been considered hostile individuals, hostile clans who were thought of as being barbaric and troublesome, extremely troublesome to their national neighbors. So the many mentions of them in these and other old documents indicate that these people actually existed from ancient times, and they continued to evolve as significant people, becoming several noteworthy nations. So where are they now? Where are these people now? Well, the identification, obviously, of these people has shifted over the centuries, which has confused many people as to who they are. And because of their ungodly status in prophecy, we see when we look at mentionings of them throughout history that people almost always associated them with people that persecuted Jews, persecuted Christians. And so Eusebius, one quote-unquote Christian author, frequently associated Gog and Magog with the Romans because of their persecution of the Jews. But after the Roman Empire had converted to a form of Christianity, a twisted form, but a form of Christianity, we see Ambrose, for example, he began identifying Gog with the Goths, who were a Germanic tribe, and Jerome identified them with Scythians, people of Iranian and Arabic origin. And some said, actually, that the Goths, the Scythians, and the Amazonians were all descendants of Gog or Magog, which I think is not entirely inaccurate. There is a mix going on here. In the 9th and 10th centuries, in the kingdoms of the Khazars, now considered to be the early Turks, they were said to be living in the lands of Gog and Magog. And this area is far north of Jerusalem, some 1,000 to 1,500 miles away. And it fits, therefore, with other references to these people. After the Khazars, the Mongols had risen up as an empire, a powerful empire, and they were then identified with Magog. And some people called them Magogoli. In fact, an individual by the name of Friar Rickold, he traveled to these lands of the Mongols in 1291, and he wrote this of his expeditions. He said, "They themselves, the Mongols, claim that they are descended from Gog and Magog, and on this account they are called Mogoli, as if from a corruption of Magogoli." And so, according to this author, apparently a considerable number of individuals of the Mongols believed that their ancestors were Gog and Magog, and it seems that they were quite proud of it. And we know that they were a very barbaric and bloodthirsty people. In the Quran, there are two chapters that discusses Gog and Magog, and in that writing, it actually misrepresents some portrayals of these people that are found in the Bible. But some Islamic art portrays these people as being half the size of regular human beings, of having hairy bodies and having claws instead of fingernails. But this, of course, does not mean that their depictions of Gog and Magog are accurate. It simply means that the Muslims also did not look fondly upon these people and considered them quite barbaric and cruel. So the next step in examining who these people are is to consider what God says that these people will do in the future, and therefore what will become of Gog and Magog. And so an examination of prophecy, if you go to Revelation 16, an examination of prophecy can help us to know who they are today and who they will be, therefore, in the future. I want to first mention, when we start looking at prophetic events, that the coming battle in the Valley of Megiddo, most people know this as the Battle of Armageddon, may likely include these people, though not specifically named. So let's look at that just for a moment. Revelation 16, and we will read verses 12 through 16, where it talks about this sixth bowl plague. The sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up, so that the way of the kings from the east might be prepared. This is a coalition of armed forces from eastern nations, east of Israel. And then John saw three unclean spirits coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. For they are spirits of demons performing signs which go out to the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them together to battle, the battle of that great day of God Almighty. Behold, I'm coming as a thief. Blessed is he who watches and keeps his garments, lest he walk naked and see his shame. And they gathered them together, it says, to the place called in Hebrew Armageddon. So this mentions this prophecy that will take place shortly before Christ returns, mentions kings from the east gathering together, a large number of people. The direction, obviously, is from a perspective of Jerusalem. That's how the prophecy works throughout the scriptures. East of Israel would be Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, and a combination of some like a dozen nations that end in the term Stan. When you continue eastward, there is India and Bangladesh, Thailand, China, and a handful of other countries, China, of course, being the most significant, populous, and powerful nation at this time in that area. Many of these national leaders will join forces to come together against the people in the Promised Land. And so if you have a ribbon or a bookmark, go ahead and put it here in Revelation, because we're going to be coming back here, but I want to go over to Daniel 11 for a moment. Daniel chapter 11. The prophecy of Daniel of future events during the Great Tribulation shows that Jerusalem will have been invaded at that time by the man of sin, this man also called the son of perdition, the leader of the beast power, according to prophecies of Daniel and the book of Revelation. And Daniel 11, verses 41 through 44 is what we will read in this regard. That says, he, speaking of this individual, shall go into the glorious land, not on his own, obviously. He will have massive army backing him up, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. And he shall stretch out his hand against the countries in the land of Egypt, shall not escape. And he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. But news from the east and from the north shall trouble him, and therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. So again, from the perspective of Israel or Jerusalem, news from the east and the north, and this is referring to Asia and Russia. So this is troublesome news, and it causes him to prepare to go out against these people. This news, this troublesome news, that is, I think, of the gathering forces. And when we consider these historical areas, therefore, of Gog and Magog that lie north and east of Israel, we see that these rising forces fall into those categories. However, none of these prophecies of the Battle of Armageddon actually refer to the people as Gog and Magog. And so the connection that I make between that battle and those people, it's speculative, but I think it is an educated speculation nonetheless. And so let's go back to Revelation, and we are going to look at chapter 20 now as we get more specific about the future of Gog and Magog. It's clear that most people of different cultures have held negative views of Gog and Magog. And the reason, I think, is likely because of the Bible, because somewhere around 590 to 570 BC, the prophet Ezekiel recorded a unique prophecy mentioning Gog and Magog, and his prophecy makes it clear that they are people that are hostile toward God's authority and toward God's faithful people. And so that would cause many to automatically begin thinking negatively of these people. Now, I had given a sermon several weeks back explaining how to discern between the different resurrections mentioned in the Bible. And one of the places that the second resurrection is mentioned is Ezekiel 37. And it speaks specifically of Israel being raised up, but this resurrection will not be ancient Israelites alone. Other scriptures indicate that Jacob's descendants who lived and died from all ages, including those people who died during the millennium, will be raised after 1,000 years. So included, therefore, will be billions of Gentiles that fall into the category of the rest of the dead, according to Revelation 20 and verse 5. Now, at the same time of the second resurrection, Satan will be released from his prison in the bottomless pit, and he will restart his wiles, and over a number of years will persuade many to reject God's authority. And after as many years of deception, the wicked will organize an uprising that will escalate into a massive march to war. Revelation 20 in verse 7 says, when the 1,000 years have expired, Satan will be released from his prison. He will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea. And they went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. So it's said that these people are considered Gog and Magog, but they not only come from the east and the north, they come from places all over the earth. It says the four corners of the earth. So to understand the reference here, we can consider what I believe to be a parallel prophecy of this same event found in Ezekiel 38. I'll obviously leave your, if you have a bookmark or a ribbon, leave it here in Revelation. Let's go over to the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel 38, and we are going to read verses 1 through 3. Now the word of the Eternal came to Ezekiel, saying, Son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, Thus says the Eternal God, Behold, I am against you, O Gog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. So these verses here, particularly the first few verses, they speak specifically that Gog is of the land, in verse 2, of Magog. And so it combines these two terms, indicating that they are a large number of people, but they're personified in an individual that is called the Prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. And these three names are interesting. They actually refer to people that became a nation, a large nation, and even a few nations down through time. Rosh was a son of Benjamin, who was later known as Ross, and it led to the term Russia, or Russia. Meshech and Tubal were sons of Japheth. They became 7th century kingdoms north of Israel, and Meshech is also known as Mashki, which led to the term Moscow, that eventually became the capital city of Russia. Tubal is also known as Tabol, which is the name of a 1,000-mile-long river today found in Russia. And it's also the name of one of the oldest known settlements in Russia called Tobolsk. Gog, therefore, is considered a prince over these people, meaning a chief person, an individual of great importance to the history and even to the genealogy of a strong nation in the northeast. But as we read on, there are other rebellious people that are included in this coming war and in the mix of individuals. Ezekiel 38, verse 5 says, Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya are with them, all of them with the shield and helmet. Gomer and all its troops, the house of Togarma from the far north, and all its troops, many people, are with you. Persia and Ethiopia, as well as Libya, are translated from Hebrew terms Paras, Cush, and Phut. Now, Paras, we can see, is very close to the expression Persia. Cush and Phut is very different than from Ethiopia and Libya, obviously. Now, Parash does refer to the Persian people who also migrated north into the area that we know of Russia today. And this, of course, led to much of the traditional culture of Russia, which we see some of their buildings that are very Persian. Cush and Phut, these are descendants of Ham, being black and Indian people originally centered in areas of Ethiopia and Libya. And this is why the English translators chose to translate Cush and Phut as Ethiopia and Libya, so because it was understood that's where these people came from, and so it would help readers to understand who and the area God was talking about. Gomer, as is mentioned in verse 6, was a son of Japheth. Togarma was a son of Gomer, and therefore a grandson of Japheth. And these are believed to lead to the many of the Arabic peoples that were once centered in modern-day Turkey and also in Saudi Arabia. These are locations, again, north and east, but also slightly south of Israel. And so now we have moved to other regions around the world. And the confederation of these people, therefore, represents a multinational alliance surrounding Israel. And it's clear that many of these people today, the descendants of these people today, continue to be unbelievers in the God of the Bible, where the vast majority of Russian people, of Indian people, African and Asian people, they have a long history of mythical religious rites that are contrary to the principles of the Bible. Many nations of these nations today are simply just atheist nations. However, in defense of the ethnicity of some of these people, just because a person may be a descendant of Gog or Magog or one of these tribes that are mentioned, Cush, Phut, what have you, it doesn't predestine them to be included among the ranks of the rebellious Gog and Magog, because everyone has or will have an opportunity to make a personal choice to live right, no matter what their ancestors may be, no matter where their ancestors came from. As Paul said about God's faithful people, it's something that I think we can apply here in principle. Romans 9 and verses 6 through 7, Paul said that they are not all Israel who are of Israel, nor are they all called children because they are the seed of Abraham. So being a physical descendant of Abraham or Jacob doesn't buy somebody any favor if they do not keep God's commandments. Those who choose to live God's way of life are the individuals that are considered Israelites indeed, spiritual Israelites, and they will be grafted into God's people. So something similar then could be said about the ungodly. You could say they are not all Gog who are of Gog, nor are they children because they are of the seed of Magog. You see, the leaders of the rebellion are destined to come from those people, but all who choose to rebel against God's way will be included in the future Gog and Magog that will eventually be destroyed. And so let's continue to look at this in verse 10, where it says, "Thus says the Eternal God, on that day it shall come to pass that thoughts will arise in your mind, and you will make an evil plan. And you will say, I will go up against a land of unwalled villages. I will go to a peaceful people who dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates." So this is proof that these will have been people that have lived peaceably for a long, long time, not learning the ways of war anymore. "And they will go up to take plunder and to take booty, to stretch out their hand against the waste places that are again inhabited, and against a people gathered from the nations who have acquired livestock and goods, who dwell in the midst of the land." So we understand the second Exodus, God will bring people back and Israel will prosper greatly for centuries during that time. And there is no need to build fortified cities to try to protect their borders from invaders. And that is what is being spoken of here. And in verse 14, this is now that these people are coming against them to try to take over the promised land. In verse 14, "Therefore, son of man, prophesy and say to Gog, thus says the Eternal God, on that day when my people Israel dwell safely, will you not know it? Yes, and that's why they're going to go try to take them over. And you will come from out of your place, from the far north, you and many peoples with you, all of them riding on horses, a great company and a mighty army. And you will come up against my people Israel like a cloud to cover the land. So numerous, it's like a cloud coming over the mountains. And it will be in the latter days. I will bring you against my land. So this is obviously not speaking of the Battle of Armageddon, because that rebellion takes place at a time, or this rebellion that we are talking about now takes place at a time when the Promised Land has not learned war for a long, long time. And the Promised Land today, the people of Israel, are learning the ways of war, perhaps forcibly, because there are many of their neighbors, national neighbors, despise them and want to kill them. And so they have to protect themselves. But this event is going to take place at a much later time. So they don't have fortified cities. They don't have walled villages. They had been greatly prospering for a long time with livestock, goods. It even says in verse 13 that they have much gold and silver in abundance. It says that Gog will come from the north. But the rebellion will not only be coming from people north of Israel. It will be a massive gathering of dissenters from all around the world. And this is evident in some of the people that we had read earlier in the chapter, but also from Revelation in chapter 20. But before we go over there, there are some that hold the opinion that this uprising here of Gog and Magog in Ezekiel 38, and as it continues into chapter 39, that this will not take place after Satan has been released from the bottomless pit, after 1,000 years of Christ's rule on the earth. Some actually feel that this uprising will occur just a few years or so after Christ has returned. And there are a few reasons why some might question my proposed placement of time of this battle. And the indication that there are unwalled cities and villages means that people will no longer, obviously, be fortifying their lands in defense from invaders. And this could mean that there are other areas around the world where people are building systems of defense. In fact, Gog and Magog will likely be erecting walls because of a declaration of war that they had been planning, which would naturally result in some form of retaliation. And so this would be the case whether or not the insurrection took place shortly after Christ's return or a millennium later. Still, some feel that because there are details included in Ezekiel's prophecy that are not included in Revelation, that these are different events. For example, Gog of the land of Magog is a chief prince of Meshech and Tabul. He comes from the north, it says. Well, Revelation 20 and verse 8 says that they come from the four corners of the earth. But is this something contrary to one another? Because Ezekiel did not say that this coalition is only from the north. He says that also Ethiopia, Libya, Gomer, Togarma, these are also with them. And these people consist of many nations that down in our time and down through the ages where they have migrated to different areas, and they can be found east, west, and south of Israel. And while Gog of Magog is primarily still located in the north, others that ally themselves with them come from other areas of the world. And so the details that may or may not be left out of one prophecy or the other does not mean that they are not the same event, because God's revelations through the prophets are known to not include all details in one place and other details are mentioned in another place. This is quite common. We understand this, a comparison of different places within the Bible that speak of the same event and leads us to rightly dividing the word of truth, as Paul instructed. And as Isaiah wrote, precept must be upon precept, line upon line, here a little, and there a little. And so that is what I think we are doing when we overlap these two mentionings of Gog and Magog that both speak of massive uprisings, both in my mind are speaking of the same period of time, a time when people have not learned war, and there is further evidence as we go forward. So another point of confusion to some anyway is that God said in Ezekiel 38:4 that he will guide these people, that he'll turn them around, lead them out with all the army and the horsemen, and lead them basically to their destruction. Now, Revelation 20 and verse 8 says that Satan will gather them together. And so some think that this means, well, God is going to lead or perhaps inspire one rebellion while Satan inspires the other. But there are two things that this view may not be considering. And the first one should be obvious, but perhaps not, is that God does not inspire people to rebel against him. James 1:13, God says he cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. So God does not inspire the rebellion of Gog and Magog, found in Ezekiel 38 and 39, nor does he inspire the rebellion in Revelation 20. In fact, Ezekiel 38:10 says, "Thus says the eternal God, on that day it shall come to pass that thoughts will arise in your mind, and you will make an evil plan." And so this is not God's inspiration. He doesn't inspire the evil plans of men, and the attack is not his doing. What it does say in Ezekiel 38:4 that we had read, he said, "I will turn you around, put hooks into your jaws, and lead you out." And so these are figurative terms, meaning that God will reel them in for the kill. He will allow them to make these evil plans, not restraining them from doing it, and then he will set a trap for the rebellion. In addition, Revelation does not specifically say that Satan brings the attackers to the land of Israel after the second resurrection, that he leads them this way. It says that he deceives the nations, he deceives them to gather them together to battle. So the deception, It includes leading people to believe that an attack on Israel can be successful. But again, it is God who allows this to happen. He doesn't inspire it, nor does he lead the attack. So an example can be found, I think, in God warning ancient Israel and Judah that he would bring Assyria down, that he would bring Babylon down to ravage the northern kingdom, to ravage the southern kingdom because of their disobedience to him. He says, prophesied beforehand of horrible things that Israel would experience because of rejecting God. And all of this would be considered his punishment. But God did not inspire the wicked people of Assyria. He did not inspire their brutal methods of war. He merely removed his protection from Israel. He allowed evil plans that were being made by heathen people to bear fruit. It's kind of like just saying, you know, God has his hands of protection over Israel. And then when they rebel and rebel and rebel and rebel against him, he eventually says, okay, you're on your own. And so it's not directly his doing. It is other people doing, but he allowed it to take place. And I think this opinion is obvious when we consider prophecies such as found in Nahum in chapter 2 and other places stating that the Assyrians based in Nineveh would suffer greatly because of their brutality against the people of Israel. So if God was the inspiration of the evil plans, he wouldn't turn around and say, oh, well, I'm going to destroy you now and make you suffer because of what you did to my people. If God were directly responsible for the bloodshed, he wouldn't have then went on to punish those heathen people for declaring war. So it's clear that Satan's deceptive ways were in full force within the nations of Assyria and within the nations of Babylon during those years when they made plans to invade the northern kingdom of Israel, the southern kingdom of Judah. But Satan is the accuser of the brethren. not God. It is he who desired to sift Peter like wheat. He is the one who inspired the war, and God simply allowed it to take place. And therefore, God claims to be the one bringing the heathen warriors to the mountains of Israel. And it's really only in part, because he's just simply removing his protection and saying, come on in. These people deserve it. So in like manner, I think God does not inspire Gog and Magog's insurrection. That is Satan's work. But how could, when you think about it, how could such evil plans and this massive insurrection be carried out shortly after Christ's return, when Satan is no longer dramatically influencing the nations because he's bound, he's locked up in a bottomless pit? I mean, what would be the point of God feeling like he needs to flex his muscle once again before the nations shortly after the world had went through the horrors of the trumpet and the bowl plagues? Would there really be a need shortly after Christ's return, or even a century after Christ's return, to show the world again the power of Almighty God, when billions of people would have already died? Millions would have lost family members. Everything in the oceans had perished. When the earth had been laid waste because of the plagues, there would have been a massive battle of Armageddon that would have saw this some 200 million man army, it's believed to have melted, basically dissolved. It says Zechariah speaks of their eyes melting in their sockets and their tongues melting in their mouths, and the mountains shaking at that time, mountains being brought down, the whole area of the Middle East around Jerusalem being reshaped to make way for the new temple to be built. I don't think there would be a need to display his power once again. I mean, how much more of a display could you have? And so the massive rebellion described by Ezekiel, in my mind, this must take place long after Christ has returned, and then after Satan is loosed, where he can go out and deceive the nations once more. Because it will be at that time when the memory of God's plagues throughout the nations will have faded over centuries. If you have a ribbon, put it here in Ezekiel, because I'm going to be coming back here, and I'd like to go back over to Revelation and chapter 20 this time. And we'll pick it up here, this final stand of ungodly men against God that will take place after the second resurrection, when billions of people will have been raised to physical life. They will have been given an opportunity for salvation, the ability to make an educated choice on what they will do, which way they will go. As Revelation 20 and verse 8 says, that Satan will go out to deceive the nations, which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. So the historical locations of Gog and Magog are not all over the world, but were found north and east of Israel. But now we see a gathering of people from the four corners of the earth. That means north, south, east, and west of Jerusalem. This shows us that all of the ungodly will come together. They will join forces, in other words, to form a massive army. It's a number so numerous that it describes it as being, if you looked out, you know, at the shoreline, as the sand being on the shoreline, that's what it would look at like if you looked at them from a distance. And again, I think this matches Ezekiel's description in chapter 38 and verse 9, where he said that they will come like a storm, covering the land like a cloud. Like a cloud coming upon the land, they are so numerous. All of your troops, he said, and many people with you. And Ezekiel 38 and verses 15 through 16 says that a great company, a mighty army, you will come up against my people, Israel, like a cloud to cover the land. So many people. It sounds much like the description here in verse 8, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. And verse 9 of Revelation 20 says that they will go up on the breadth of the earth and surround the camp of the saints and the beloved city. Now, the breadth of the earth may cause some people to think that this is just one large open area, but that is not what is being referred to here. It means a large expanse of land is what it is talking about, and I think this matches Ezekiel's description of them being in the mountains and on the open field, a large expanse of land. As it continues to say in verse 9, it will surround the camp of the saints in the beloved city. And then fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. Well, again, this matches if you go over to Ezekiel 39 this time. This fire devouring the individuals. This matches their end as described by Ezekiel. Well, let's look at verse 1. And you, son of man, prophesy against Gog and say, thus says the eternal God, behold, I am against you, O Gog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, and I will turn you around, lead you on, bringing you up from the far north against the mountains of Israel. And I will knock the bow out of your left hand and cause the arrows to fall out of your right hand. You shall fall upon the mountains of Israel, you and all your troops and all the peoples that are with you. I will give you to the birds of prey of every sort and to the beasts of the field to be devoured. You shall fall on the open field, for I have spoken, says the eternal God, and I will send fire on Magog and on those who live in security in the coastlands, and then they shall know that I am the eternal. So both prophecies, Revelation 20, Ezekiel 39, indicate that the rebels are destroyed by fire. Revelation says devoured by fire. This just says bringing fire upon them, being sent down upon them. But one thing I would like to point out is that this does not necessarily mean that the fire will instantly turn these people to ash. This term is used 8 other places in the New Testament. Fire coming down, consuming them, devouring them, I should say. And in many of these other places, it speaks of devouring widows or devouring neighbors, and it simply means bringing great harm upon these individuals. And so the term in Revelation doesn't have to mean that their bodies and their weapons are going to be turned to ash. And when we compare it, therefore, to Ezekiel 39 and verse 6 that we had just read, the fire kills them. And then the prophecy goes on to say, if we continue reading in this book, it goes on to say that it will take 7 months after this to bury all of the bodies of those individuals. So numerous, 7 months, the people of Israel will be burying the bodies. And it also says that the primitive weapons of war that will be used during that battle will be used as fuel, as firewood, for 7 years. And the reason there will be primitive weapons used by these armies is because for centuries, people will not have been learning the way of war. They will not have developed submachine guns and nuclear missiles and tanks and bazookas and all of these weapons that we have available today. And so it is my opinion, therefore, that if this event were, for some reason, to take place a few years after Christ returns, even a century after Christ returns, there would be plenty of technology around available for that army to gather weapons that are not made of wood, things that would be more effective, like machine guns, missiles, or what have you. There is also some confusion I want to mention because we had just read verse 2, some confusion regarding verse 2, where the New King James translation that I am reading today, this says, I will turn you around and lead you on, bringing you up from the far north against the mountains of Israel, so leading them down to destruction. A few translations, such as the King James, says, I will turn thee back and leave but the sixth part of thee and cause thee to come up from the north parts. So there's something inserted there that is quite different from the New King James and most other translations of the Bible. The latter, the one I had read from the King James, seems to say that a sixth of the rebels will be left alive. Well, sixth, as translated in the King James, it comes from the Hebrew term shasha, which means to annihilate. According to most scholars, the mistranslation of sixth comes from, because the Hebrew term shashah, if you add an H on the end of it, shashah means to divide into sixths. So according to Strong's exhaustive concordance and other people who have studied Greek and Hebrew terms, this, it says, translating shasha as a sixth part in Ezekiel 39:2 was done by confusing the two terms. They're very similar. Shasha and shasha are very similar. But again, if this were to take place a short period of time after Christ returns, the rubble from the weapons that would be left over could be used by the rebels, and it wouldn't lead to them fashioning wood for wooden weapons for war. Let's go over to Isaiah this time. Isaiah and chapter 19. One wonders how people, how they could consider that there is a good opportunity here to overthrow the camp of the saints, to come in and overthrow Israel after God's government has been established on the earth for 1,000 years. Well, I think the reason that many will be persuaded is multifaceted. But first, we do need to consider Satan is a powerful foe. He is very persuasive. His deception can be very effective on people, particularly when they let their guard down. And so these people will have allowed themselves to entertain selfish and wicked thoughts and behaviors after Satan is released. And the reason, I think, is because the memories of many will have faded after 1,000 years of peace and prosperity. Many of these individuals will never even have seen the Great Tribulation because they will be have raised from ancient times or times before Christ had returned and the Great Tribulation would have taken place. And so these events of the Great Tribulation will have become pages in centuries-old history books. And so many of those raised from the dead will have not experienced it, and others will consider, maybe those events were exaggerated. Maybe it wasn't as bad as people say it was. And so I think for many, the power of God, of his anger, of his wrath against rebellious people, it won't be as tangible any longer. And like some Democrats in the nation of America today, I think they are more knowledgeable and we're much more sophisticated, some think today, that, you know, than people in the past, that we can do socialism right this time. Communism's not such a bad thing if we do it the right way. We have much more information and much more control, and we're more compassionate now. We can do it right this time. But it's the history has shown this is what will happen if you go that direction. This is the pattern that human nature will follow if it is not directed by God. And so many of these people will be swayed by the devil to go contrary to God's way, living the way of get instead of God's way of give. And so God will send fire on the armed forces of Gog and Magog, but not the invading forces only. It said, as we had read, that he will send fire on those who live in security in the isles or the islands. It's talking about the nations. This expression, I think, likely refers to the allies, the friends, the families of those individuals who marched off to war. Because those who support the uprising but do not physically march off to, women and children aren't going to march off to war, but they're going to totally support what their husband, their brothers, and what others are doing. They won't physically travel, and they'll think, well, we're safe and secure. We fortified our borders, our cities here, because making plans to attack another nation obviously would lead to an understanding that a declaration of war would likely mean retaliation, so they'll attempt to fortify themselves, their secure their cities and their villages beforehand. But there's another interpretation of this verse that is interesting. Some translations read, that God will send fire on Magog and among them that dwell carelessly in the isles, in the nations. And so this would mean that those nations who think that they can do whatever they want, that they can attack the camp of the saints, that they can disobey God and get away with it, it's really living carelessly. Really, you might think you're safe and secure, but they have another thing coming. In conclusion, though, I want to mention that Gog and Magog, it's obvious that Gog and Magog has existed from a long time, from ancient times, and they exist today, and those people will continue to exist into the millennium and until the final rebellion. But not all of those people who are of the clans, those people who are found among the ranks of Gog and Magog, not all of those people will reject or will have rejected God and his way of life. Many will choose God's way of life, and therefore they will be considered good people, faithful people, and not among the ranks of Gog and Magog. As it says in Isaiah 19 and verse 23, of those people who were not once considered God's people, during the millennium, it says, in that day, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian will come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptians will serve with the Assyrians. And in that day, Israel will be one with three, working together positively, faithfully toward God, one with three, with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the land, whom the Eternal of Hosts shall bless, saying, blessed is Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance. So those who are faithful toward God are considered God's people. He calls them, the Egyptians and the Assyrians that are faithful, my people. And so therefore they are considered the spiritual seed of Abraham, a seed who God said would be as numerous as the number of stars. And that would include bringing in some of these other people, these other nations, these other ethnicities. No matter who their forefathers may have been, they have a choice to make. And therefore, because the coalition of forces and the involvement of people from the four corners of the earth in the last stand of men against God's authority, many of these physical descendants are of Gog and Magog, but not all of them. Because these terms being used prophetically, they represent ungodly people from a variety of nations, a variety of backgrounds, a variety of locations all around the world, and even from all ages. So leaders and significant numbers of people will come from Persia, from Russia, Asia, from the Arab people, from Indian and African nations. But the rebels will not all be Gentiles or people of color. There will be numbers of Caucasians among the mix who, because they will all be considered people who reject, who choose to reject God's government, to fight against his people. And so no matter what the ethnicity of these individuals, all who rebel against keeping God's commandments will be considered among the ranks of the rebellious Gog and Magog, and there will be nowhere for them to hide, whether they march off to the promised land to war or if they stay home thinking they are safe and secure among the isles or among the nations.